Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, coming to you from a freezing night in Texas. Of course, my guest lives in the Northeast and is probably shaking her fist at me. She is Elizabeth Baer. She's won a couple of Hugo Awards for short fiction, a Sturgeon Award, and a Locust Award for Best First Novel. She was the recipient of the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer in 2005. Her newest novel, Karen Memory, came out this week. Hi.
Hi. And actually, I think through the vagaries of meteorology, we're at about the same temperature because it has been gorgeous and warm in, by our standards, in New England this week. So you're oh my God, I'm dying, it's cold, and our wow, this is beautiful, everybody run around in shirt sleeves is probably approximately equivalent.
Yeah, I'm really grouchy that I haven't been able to play golf for like 5 days this winter, you know, so.
Actually, we're having a really nice mild winter, which we have earned with great suffering over the course of the last 2 years. We're getting our projected worst snowstorm of the winter tomorrow, and we're only supposed to get 3 to 6 inches, well, which is kind of glorious.
That's fantastic. You know, you can. Your heating bill will thank you, I'm sure.
Oh, well, yeah, between that and the lower oil prices.
I know. Is that bizarre or what? I feel like I'm living in the 1980s.
I have been saying that. Between that and the fact, okay, I just bought a new yoga cover-up top, and it is cobalt blue and bat-winged and has a crossover rear V-neck. And I put this thing on, and I suddenly felt 16. I didn't look 16, but batwing sleeves. Batwing sleeves are back.
Well, when I look at my wife's closet, she always reminds me that it all comes back at some point, so you can't get rid of it.
Yes, it does. She's been proven absolutely correct. I had the horrible realization the other day that we are, brace yourself, get a drink. We are now as far removed in time from 1985 as 1985 was from 1955.
Damn, that's crazy.
Isn't it?
That'll make you feel old.
1985 is the Korean War from when I was in high school.
Wow.
Yeah. So kids these days, right?
I mean, that means the first Gulf War will be like the Korean War. I mean,
exactly.
In a couple of years.
Yeah, yeah. So kids these days have every reason to think we're old and broken.
Well, they're not far off.
They're not wrong.
That's for sure. Well, I'm really excited to have you on tonight. I just mentioned that your new book, Karen Memory, is coming out this week, or it came out this week when this show airs.
Yes.
This is
in the future.
Yeah, in the future, through the magic of the internet. This is something like your like 30th novel book thing. I mean, you were first published in 2005. Like, that's an amazing output.
Yeah, I just had my 10-year publication anniversary, actually, was December 28th, which is the anniversary of the day, 10-year anniversary of the day Hammered came out. I had published short stuff before then, but, you know, like the novel is like, it's like your wedding anniversary. It erases all of the prior anniversaries in the relationship. So, you know, your novel publication anniversary erases all those other previous short fiction and whatever else. So I have written 27 novels, including collaborations and a couple of Shadow Unit novels. Shadow Unit is this collaborative thing I did with Emma Bull and Sarah Monette and 7 or 8 other people, available for free online at shadowunit.org. And also you can buy the nicely formatted ebooks on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. But the altogether 27 novels.
In basically, I mean, I'm sure the first one was written before 2005, obviously, and maybe a few of the others were in the works. But that's a crazy output. I mean, you're badging about 3 a year for the last 10 years.
Oh well, I had actually written I don't even know 7 or 8 of them, maybe more by the time my. Okay, do I have time to count on my fingers?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, play girl for me, Benima. by the time Hammered had come out, I had written the 3 Edda of Burdens books, which are All the Windwrecked Stars, The Sea Thy Mistress, and By the Mountain Bound. I'd written One-Eyed Jack. I'd written Blood and Iron, A Companion to Wolves, The Cobbler's Boy, which has never been published. It's Sarah Monette and I. It's a YA historical thing that we haven't managed to sell yet. The Stratford Man, which is actually two books. And all three of the Jenny Casey books. So that's 12. So I had actually written 12 books by the time the first one came out.
The fact that you can name 12 books off the top of your head is pretty incredible.
I can remember the order in which I wrote them. So.
Wow. It's just like always the question you ask, the mother with six kids, what are the names of your children? And
they have to go through them all.
Yeah, in order, right. That makes sense.
Yeah, I have to too. It's like naming the reindeer. You have to do them by sets.
Right. Yeah, it's the rhythm of the. Do you have a song? You should have a song that you sing them to. That would be fantastic.
I should have a song. I don't have a song. I should.
You should talk to Seanan about filking that for you. I think that would be. That's really what needs to happen.
I think that's an excellent plan.
Yeah. So you had a lot of these written beforehand, but you don't really have a huge unpublished catalog, right? Like almost everything you've finished is published.
I have one book that hasn't been published at this point, which is that the Cobbler's Boy.
It's a pretty good track record.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
And you've written several books with Sarah Monette, who has gotten some phenomenal attention this year for a book under her new pseudonym, Catherine Addison, The Goblin Emperor.
Yes, The Fabulous Goblin Emperor. I'm so in love with this book. I feel like it's a real, I don't know. I really like her Doctrine of Labyrinth books, but I feel like the Goblin of Emperor is a maturing of her work. It's got more stuff going on simultaneously. And, we have actually just handed in the third and final of our, collaborative, Wolf books. The third in the Companion to Wolves trilogy, long delayed. I think it's 4 or 5 years overdue at this point.
Y'all are very busy.
A lot of stuff has been going on.
Yeah, no, I've been a big proponent of the Goblin Emperor. I think it's fantastic. Liz Burke and I have been concocting some way to launch some massive awards campaign for it. So,
Well, I'm totally nominating it. It's on my list. It's steampunk, elves, and politics. How can you say no?
Yeah, I heard somebody, because of course everything has to be compared to Game of Thrones, right? So I heard somebody say it was like, it's like Game of Thrones without the violence or the sexism or the weird sexual stuff.
It's like Game of Thrones, except it's not like Game of Thrones at all. Exactly. It's a different kind of fantasy. It's not like Game of Thrones. It's not like Lord of the Rings. It's not, actually the thing that I think it's most like is Ray Feist and Jenny Wirtz, Daughter of the Empire. Speaking of the 1980s.
Very interesting touchstone, that one. Yeah, I actually just wrote today, and it'll probably post next week, but that I actually think it's a super innovative book, which is strange because it doesn't really, when you read it, you don't really feel like it's innovative right at first, but the more you think about it, it's doing all kinds of things that we don't like our fantasy to do, but it totally works. So
it totally works. It's a fantasy where most of these tension and conflict and plot complications come from politics. And most of those politics happen off stage. And what we're seeing is it's Sandbaggers, the novel. I don't know if you're familiar with the British spy show Sandbaggers.
I'm not.
Okay. Sandbaggers was a late 1970s, early 1980s. And it is one of the really strong influences on, like, Greg Rucka's Queen and Country and Spooks, which I think was – Spooks had a different title in the U.S. MI6? MI5? Something like that. And what Sandbaggers is it is a bureaucratic spy thriller. It's about – the one guy who sits in the office pulling the strings, worrying about his field agents, arguing with the bureaucracy for money, and it's very much all about the not the immediate tension of the James Bond character who's out there in the field, but like M is the protagonist.
Yeah, I love that concept. As somebody who worked in politics for a decade, mm-hmm. it is super gratifying to see somebody actually talk about how politics really work.
You would like sandbaggers.
Yeah, which is just bureaucracy. It's navigating bureaucracy. I don't know how you make that interesting, but I think Sarah Monette manages to do it in that book. So it's a pretty huge achievement in that regard. So
and it's not a depressing book.
Not at all. No.
Yours for less depressing fantasy in 2015.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, we've gotten to the point where it's strange to imagine though, that we've gotten to a point where fantasy that makes you feel good is new and fresh.
It's radical. It's punk rock. Fantasy that does not make you want to chew your wrists open is the new punk rock.
So you have Karen Memory out, which, mm-hmm. well, for those who don't know, why don't you just give me a brief, give me your elevator pitch on it so we can get a baseline.
Karen Memory, and I'm really good at this because I've spent all day writing blog posts about it. Karen Memory is a Weird West steampunk thriller about a group of resourceful parlor girls, which is a euphemism that means exactly what you think it means. It's basically heroic prostitutes versus disaster capitalists with steampunk.
Perfect. That's perfect. When I read this book, and I loved it for a host of reasons, but the one thing that really stuck in my mind was that you take on something that we totally lambaste people for all the time, which is using a trope. And the trope is, you know, the quote unquote hooker with a heart of gold. Mm-hmm. And you just go right after it. I assume that you saw that trope and you thought to yourself, well, God damn it. I can do that. I can do that right.
Okay, well, the thing about the quote unquote hooker with a heart of gold is that it's one of those things that is not, you know, sex workers are people. Sex workers are human beings. The problem with the hooker with a heart of gold trope is, and I'm going to say it. Oh my God, get the hatchet. It's the male gaze issue, right? It's the pretty woman thing where this character exists to be miserable and then be rescued in some way. Mm-hmm. That's it's the Victorian redemption arc where the woman is in some miserable circumstances and is incapable of doing anything about them herself, so somebody has to come along and make it better for her. You know, she has to get picked up by a rich man who falls in love with her because of her intrinsic goodness or whatever. I mean, that's the real problem with the trope. The problem with the trope is not that, oh my God, you know, sex workers can't be decent human beings, because of course they can. Right. You know, I know people who have worked in the sex trade. I know people who have been prostitutes and dominatrixes, and they're folks. It's not. So I guess that's my issue with the quote unquote hooker with a heart of gold trope. The thing that I tried very much to do with the working girls, or to use the period euphemism, the seamstresses in Karen Memory, is to present a female homosocial environment. There are so many stories, so many narratives that are focused on male homosocial environments, you know, environments in which there are basically no women. The entire war movie genre. And all of its fantasy spinoffs. And some of them are brilliant. They're wonderful, you know, wonderful stories to be told in these almost exclusively male environments. I just saw the Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf vehicle Fury, which is actually a really good movie and has a completely fantastic tank battle that consists largely of a camouflage tiger tank chewing up an entire battle group of Sherman tanks from behind cover, which is historically accurate. You know, there is absolutely nothing wrong with movies about that kind of environment. The thing is, there's also absolutely nothing wrong with stories about intensely female environments, but we're not encouraged to tell them. And if we do tell them, we're really not encouraged to tell them to a mixed audience. Mm-hmm. You know, they're supposed to be aimed only at women. And it's not like there aren't any male characters in Care and Memory, because of course there are. There are at least two or three.
Well, sure, the bad
and they
guy.
Even, they even talk to each other. They even talk to each other. And a couple of Karen's sidekicks are male.
Yes.
And the cat is a boy. so, that, you know, and I've written books that had almost exclusively male casts because I was telling a war story set in a period where there weren't female soldiers or something like that. But I guess my point is that there's validity to all of these environments and validity to the stories that are told there. And the thing is that you get the same breadth of characters in any of them. Not all women are the same person, which is the thing you lose when you have, you know, the Ocean's 11 Smurfette trope, mm-hmm. where you have 12 male characters and one female character in a narrative, because that female character is therefore, you know, she's the Devi. She is all women incarnate. It's kind of what was going on in my head at the time, is that that and I just really wanted to write a story about a bunch of prostitutes kicking ass.
Is seamstresses actually a period term or not something you made up?
That is actually a period term. And the whole thing about there being a sewing machine tax that was charged to prostitutes, the $50 a week sewing machine tax in the 1880s and 1890s, $50 was a lot of money. So you can imagine that these women probably weren't taking in
there just wasn't that much need for tailoring.
Yeah, there just was not that much need for tailored shirts. These ladies were not stitching up buttonholes, and mending torn hems,
right.
And paying the city. The city of Seattle probably would not exist as the municipality it is today if it had not taxed its prostitutes so heavily.
I'm now imagining you. When you come across this term, seamstress, and all the history here, and I can almost see what you took that term and you
can see the thought process there.
Yes, I mean the sewing machine becomes a very central theme within the story.
It's the central metaphor, yeah. It's but because it's a steampunk story, it's not any sewing machine. It's a, you know, black iron and hydraulic chrome detailed Singer mecca that you get inside and walk around in like Ripley in the forklift suit and Aliens, which was totally what I had in mind when I was writing those scenes. I mean, that's, you know, it's very much Ripley fighting the alien queen.
It's got a little Pacific Rim to it as well, maybe. You know?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe a little, yeah.
A little sewing machine Jaeger.
Little sewing machine Jaeger, sure.
You know, as you do.
Although I wrote the book before I saw Pacific Rim, largely.
I presume, yes. I figured that
Sadly.
Was probably true.
Clearly, Del Toro walked into that movie with the attitude that his fucks would grow back. You know? Like, I can use these up now because they will regenerate if I need them later. And I think that's why it's such a delightful movie.
Yeah, that's a movie that just, you're right. It just didn't give a shit. It's like, no. I am just going to have a boatload of fun and screw any sort of, mm-hmm. of my art. And, you know, I'm just going to put my artistic chops aside for a little while, which is wonderful.
Well, I think that, but he didn't. You know, I mean, the there's a great deal of visual narrative artistry in that film. There's a lot made of, you know, okay, the plot's kind of stupid and the science is kind of stupid and giant robots and giant monsters wouldn't work that way. That doesn't matter. That's extraneous to the narrative logic of the film. The narrative logic of the film works beautifully. Mm-hmm. The emotional logic of the film works beautifully. And there's so much of it that's just carried in what in a graphic novel would, just be visual passages that would have no dialogue. You know, the entire relationship between the two Russian characters, they have essentially no dialogue, and yet you walk away from that movie feeling a great tragic affection for both of them.
Absolutely. And sort of similar to Karen Memory in another way is that Del Toro sort of says to us, you know how this movie goes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, America swoops in and saves the day or whatever. It's not that, you know, it's actually a different thing entirely. And I think you're doing that in Karen Memory as well with all the various tropes that you're kind of playing off of. We've talked about one, but it's not the only one. I mean, you also, by setting it in the period that you set it in, you've also sort of put yourself against some other things that people can struggle with sometimes, which is like you have a very prominent black character who mm-hmm. has to deal with that. He also has a Native American sidekick. And so it's almost like a Lone Ranger situation, which if I remember correctly, that Lone Ranger movie was tragic.
I have not actually seen the Lone Ranger movie because I have a little too much self-respect.
Yes, right. I didn't see it either, but I heard it was horribly racist.
So here's the fantastic thing, and spoilers, so fast forward about 5 minutes if you don't want to know this particular thing. Bass Reeves is the only real historical character in the book. U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves, real guy.
Really?
Yes, former slave, badass U.S. Marshal in the Indian Territory, what is these days Oklahoma. He's the actual historical model for the Lone Ranger.
Well, look at that. That's awesome.
I know who is a whitewashed Bass Reeves. And that thing with the silver dollars, he actually did that.
See, I love that. This is like when historical novels really work, is when you have this fun stuff.
And he is the only actual historical character in the books, other than some people like Rutherford B. Hayes, who are sort of mentioned in passing. Madame Damnable is loosely modeled on Seattle's Mother Damnable, who was an amazing woman, a legendary figure in Seattle frontier history. But Bass Reeves, real guy. There's a book. The book is entitled Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves by Art T. Burton. And it's very dry because Mr. Burton is a historian, and fully 60% of this book is transcripts of historical documentation.
I just nodded off for a second.
That's about as just exactly as thrilling as you think it is. But the first 40% of the book is a narrative of Bass Reeves' life and the legendary surrounding him. The thing about him is that he was, as described in Karen Memory, he was an incredibly handsome man. There are photos of him, and he was a large, striking, I believe the term would be a well-made man, a well-proportioned man, with hooded eyes and a serious expression and a mustache that would not be out of place on a 21st century hipster. A spectacular mustache on this gentleman. I doing the research for the book, I needed a lawman. And I was of the opinion that if I needed a lawman, I might as well go for the best. And Bad Masterson and Wyatt Earp get a lot of press, but there were other guys out there doing the same job. Mm-hmm.
You obviously made a knowing choice when you introduced a character of color into a world that hadn't fully come to grips with civil rights. And yet, I think one of the things I've heard Kate Elliott talk about this ad nauseum, and she's totally right, and it needs to be talked about ad nauseum because it's a problem. Every time we make assumptions about how things were in the past, right? Mm-hmm. That, well, there could never be a black character with agency back in the 1800s because that wasn't allowed back then, or we can't have women doing heroic things because women weren't allowed to do those things. the way you portrayed him in the book, do you think that was an accurate portrayal of what life was like in his situation back then? Or do you think you rose-colored it at all?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we know some stuff about Bass Reeves. He was, you know, he was an ex-slave. He was illiterate. And that he was a multiply, you know, I don't know if decorated is the right word, but he was an extremely respected United States Marshal who, had the reputation, you know, who served under, I think it was the sixth district court, but the famous quote unquote hanging judge, Judge Parker, you know, that guy. Yeah. And, he was the hard case guy. He was the guy you sent out when you had to get somebody who nobody else was willing to go get because it was too dangerous. And part of the reason that he was good at this was because when he was a runaway slave, he lived in the Indian Territory. So he had a network of friendships and relationships there. And he could walk with impunity into situations that a clueless white guy couldn't. And those are the kind of communities where a desperado might go to hide out. Mm-hmm. So there are advantages to being a marginalized person. And there's a thing that I describe him doing in the book where he memorizes his warrants because he can't read.
Right.
The real Bass Reeves actually did that. He apparently had a phenomenal, trained memory. And what he would do is he would get somebody to read the warrants to him, and then he would memorize the descriptions in them and be able to recite the warrant. Very, very impressive human being. Also had about 20 kids. I don't know when he had time, but
came home just in time, I guess, every time.
Seriously. 20 may be an exaggeration, but it was a lot. Significant number. Well represented in the gene pool, I would say, probably to this day.
Kind of looping back a little bit, it seems to me that, like, as we talk about getting away from the default character types and some of the traps that a lot of writers can fall into, it seems like one of the key things is that you've been particularly good about throughout your career, and I've read a lot of your work, and I know you've written about this before in blog posts or whatever, but it seems that you empower these people of marginalized people with agency, and that's what allows it to work. I mean, that's what allows you to use these more challenging character types that others can't, because you, well, not that they can't, but they don't, because they don't empower them the way you do.
Well, because people make assumptions that because society oppresses someone that person has no agency. Agency is an eternal thing. I invite anybody who is struggling with I invite anybody who is struggling with this idea that people who are in an oppressive social situation have no agency to read the work of people who are in an oppressive social situation and yet manage to have agency. I invite anybody on the planet to read, for example, Solomon Northrup's 12 Years a Slave, which is not just an amazing piece of work. It's a stylistic and literary masterpiece. It's a great fucking book. It's gripping. This is not dry history or boring memoir. It is visceral. It's heartrending. It is an enormously gorgeous piece of work. You know, in addition to being the true life narrative of a man who was a New Yorker who was kidnapped from his home, enslaved, and shipped off to the South to work on plantations before, you know, managing to smuggle a letter out to people who knew him in New York, who then, you know, basically came to fetch him and testify that he was free. And just the amazing amount of work and planning and sneaking around and you know, spy behind enemy lines that this guy had to do to prove that he was a free man. If, you know, anybody who thinks that somebody who is enslaved or who is socially oppressed because they're female or because they're trans or because they're gay doesn't have any agency is deluding themselves. You know, it's like saying, oh, well, I'm not a member of the wealthiest 1%. I don't have any agency because there are other people in society who are more powerful than I am. Mm-hmm. It makes exactly as much sense as that. You know, reading the work of Mary Wollstonecraft or other female writers of that period who were basically unpeople. You know, they belonged to their father until they married, and then once they married, they belonged to their husband. They didn't have any rights as an individual human being. It doesn't mean they didn't have a brain. It doesn't mean they didn't take action. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue I have with this idea that there's nothing interesting to say about, for example, women in fantasy, because historical women, quote, didn't do anything. And of course, you know, I mean, that's a delusion in itself. Historical women were 50% of the economy, probably more than that, you know, because they did more than 50% of the work. There is an Australian female medieval fantasist.
Sarah Douglas,
that's it. Yes, yeah, Sarah Douglas, who's a medievalist, who writes very accurate, medievally grounded fantasy that is almost entirely about women and what women do. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, I mean, there's interesting stuff to be said here because this is unmined territory. We don't talk about what the women were doing in terms of logistics and support and defense when their husbands and brothers and sons were off fighting wars. You know, the food to support the army comes from somewhere.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's, and actually, Elizabeth, I don't know if she pronounces her last name Wine or Vine, W-E-I-N, is doing some really interesting stuff with this in her YA World War II novels, Codename Verity and Rose Under Fire, where she talks about women's actions, you know, women's what women did during the war effort.
Yeah, Codename Verity is on that list of books that I know I need to read, but
oh my god, stock up on Kleenex.
That's why I haven't read it. I can't handle the the emotional impact.
Oh, that book. I made the mistake of I was listening to it on audiobook, right? And I had gotten to like the last hour and a half of it, and I was like, oh, I'll take the dog for a walk and listen to the audiobook. I'm literally, you know, jogging down this country road past the horse farm in the little 3,000 person rural town in Massachusetts that I live in, tears streaming down my face, sobbing, trying to, you know, turn my head so that the guy out in the field calling the horses in for dinner doesn't notice that I'm just a wreck, jogging and sobbing, you know, and I play Zombies Run, so I'm used to jogging and sobbing. But speaking of pathos, I think they may actually be selling jogging and sobbing t-shirts at this point. The Zombies Run people, anyway.
You know, I would worry that if I was running and sobbing, you know, people would get the wrong idea. You know, I'd be concerned citizens or something. Yeah. I'd be very nervous about that.
Well, and there's also the danger of like running into a pickup truck because you can't see.
Right. And I actually find audiobooks impart that emotional content a little bit better even than print books. So
some of them do. Yeah. If they're well read.
Yeah.
If well read, they're great.
You mentioned the fact that somebody like Sarah Douglas is doing a better job at this, about portraying these different periods. And I'm actually kind of excited. A Crown for Cold Silver, which is a major launch coming from Orbit Books in April. And of course, we had a huge launch of Mirror Empire last year. These are books that everybody's talking about.
Oh, this is the thing you guys were tweeting about with the mystery novelist.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that Cameron Hurley and I are doing massive investigative reporting to figure out who the hell this person
is. It's KJ Parker.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Wouldn't that be funny?
It would be funny. It is. Yeah. So A Crown for Cold Silver, and interesting thing about it is, of course, Cameron has blurbed it, and blurbed it largely based on the fact that it's doing some of the same stuff that Mirror Empire does. But the fact that we're starting to see these huge launch titles that that publishers are putting money behind are also books that are portraying trans characters and, you know, women in dominant positions, people of color. I mean, there's a woman with a mustache in A Crown for Cold Silver, you know, all kinds of new and different things. Like, do you think we're starting to get to the point where this is going to become sort of the quote unquote new normal?
I sure hope so. I a while ago, there was somebody or another who was opining that our generation, quote unquote, of science fiction and fantasy writers had nothing new to offer. That all we were doing was nostalgia. And first of all, bullshit. Second of all, the thing about my generation of science fiction and fantasy writers, which is now not even the new generation of science fiction and fantasy writers, because we've been here for 10, 15 years at this point. You know, the group that includes, say, you know, like Charlie Strauss and me has been around for 15 years, which is kind of terrifying to think about. Actually, we've been around for like 25 years, but we've been in the public eye for, you know, upwards of 15 years. Mm-hmm. There's another generation now breaking in behind us, right? It's people like John Chu and Ken. But the thing about my group of writers is that we're all like, not all of us, but the vast majority of us are in some way, quote unquote, marginalized. Even most of the, what you would generally think of as, you know, straight white cis dudes are third culture kids in some way. They grew up, in another culture. They have spent a significant amount of their time somewhere where they were not in the majority culture. And there are so many women, so many people of color, so many trans people. So, I mean, just, it's no longer this thing where there's, you know, two black science fiction writers and maybe one Asian guy. It's a whole generation of different perspectives. And yes, some of what we're doing is going back and interrogating things that our predecessors and our mentors and our more adult colleagues said and arguing with them from different points of view. But I don't think that's narcissism. I mean, if I go back and write a Weird West story, it's not because I want to write something that Joe Lansdale did better 20 years ago. Although God knows I'm a huge fan of Joe Lansdale's, and I have the complete collected, Lansdale, Truman, Jonah Hex, sitting on my to read at the top of my to read pile currently. It's because we feel like there are things to say about that stuff that hasn't been said because our perspective hasn't been heard. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like when Aliette de Bodard goes and writes a space station story, it's not because she feels like she needs to write a John Varley story. It's because she feels like there's stuff to be said that isn't, you know, that wasn't in his awareness.
I love that you've just named a couple of old white guys that we don't talk about that much anymore. But
who, Lansdale and Varley?
Yes. I mean, Lansdale a little bit, but Varley's very out of the eye now these days. But
You know, there's a lot of his 80s stuff, 70s and 80s stuff, I guess, that I think was for the time extremely innovative and was very, very good work. And, I think some of it is hard to read now because it's the same thing as handing a 20-something a copy of War for the Oaks.
Yeah.
And they read it and they're like, but this is nothing but standard urban fantasy tropes. And then you're like, yeah, look at the publication date. Mm-hmm. The reason this book is nothing but standard urban fantasy tropes is because everybody else who has written urban fantasy has copied from it.
Well, that's the amazing thing. You know, things that even I'm now old enough to have read things 15 years ago that I thought that were cutting edge, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're just old hat. And even things that 10 years old, you know, I do a reread on Tor.com, and it's like what I thought was super innovative when I read it the first time isn't anymore. And that's a challenge. And every new generation is looking back at what came before. I always think that's a bullshit criticism, whatever.
Well, and there's also the thing, there's also the thing where, as we become more experienced as readers and as we read more deeply in the history of the genre, we start to realize that yes, every generation does have to do a certain amount of inventing the wheel. I'm on the Tiptree jury this year, and there have been a couple of things that I've read, and I've been like, well, how is this not The Left Hand of Darkness? And then I'm like, you know what? This person probably has not read The Left Hand of Darkness, because they were -20 when it came out.
Yeah.
You know, their parents might not have been born yet when that book came out.
Yep. And there's so much choice now that you have to really make an effort to go read that stuff. You really have to say, like, I want to read that. And it's not easy, and especially in declining shelf space. It's not like you're going to trip over it in the bookstore.
Yimini, yeah. And I mean, I can't keep up. It's my job. It's your job. It's our job to keep up on current science fiction and fantasy. And, you know, I feel like my virtue name is probably middle-aged woman afraid of her bookshelves. So
I like it.
If people still get virtue names, yes. You know. Yes.
So I can't let you go tonight without talking a little bit about the voice in the book. I've, you know, read other works by you, and you always have a distinctive voice. But this is a voice book.
Yeah. I think so, actually. I don't necessarily, I used to write a lot more first person than I do now. And part of the reason that I got away from it was because I was telling stories that I did not, that were so complicated that I didn't have the skill to tell them from a single point of view. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
There have been a number of books that I wrote as a single point of view and then had to go back and insert other points of view. All the Windrack Stars, Blood and Iron, because there was so much stuff going on that was off stage that the protagonist was not aware of, that it became incredibly confusing and frustrating for the reader.
Yeah.
And, like All the Windrack Stars was a first person novel in its original incarnation. And I was doing a noir thing. I was very much trying to do the Maltese Falcon. Here's the protagonist who's just running, and has no clue what's going on and is trying to stay ahead of the dead bodies. It wasn't working. I didn't have the skill set to pull it off. You know, what I learned is that those old noir writers were really the Dashiell Hammetts and Raymond Chandlers of the world were really good at their job. And it takes an awful lot of chops to pull that off. It looks effortless. It looks easy. Sarah Paretsky is another one who can do it really well. Her protagonist, speaking of modern writers who do the same thing, the protagonist can be confused, but the reader doesn't become frustrated. Mm-hmm. Or feel stagnated as a result of it. And I didn't have the skill set to do that. So I started writing these more books with a more intricate point of view because I didn't have the skill set to do a more elegant single point of view. And, you know, my first published novel, Hammered, also has a first person protagonist with a very distinctive voice. Jenny Casey. And I feel like when you're writing a first person protagonist, they live or die by their voice. They have to be somebody who you would take out to dinner and keep buying drinks for just to keep them talking. I try to be aware of the fact as a writer that the reader has to be entertained. Like I'm not penance. I don't want people reading my books because they feel like they're good for them. This is not a vitamin pill. This is an article of joy and relaxation and fun. And it may also be useful to you and helpful and cathartic. because I like books that do all of those things simultaneously. But, you know, I don't want to be bored, but I also I don't want to be bored because the story is boring, and I don't want to be bored because there's not enough complicated stuff going on. And it turns out that's not easy to do. So I think Karen's voice and Karen's narrative and the way she tells the story is very much, I mean, it's what attracted me to writing the story. I would never have written it if it weren't for her charisma, you know, her wanting to, and her turns of phrase and her sarcasm and she's got a mouth on her.
she does. Yeah. I have to ask you a question about first person POV.
Sure.
That drives me absolutely crazy. How much thought do you put into where your narrator is now when you're writing a first person novel?
Like the frame, like where,
yeah,
where like, talking from?
Yes.
I have to know that, actually. I have to know, and I blame Roger Zelazny for this. Because I spent the entirety of the first five Amber novels wondering who the hell Corwin was telling the story to.
It drives me crazy. This is particularly a problem in like urban fantasy novels that are using first person past, and they're not telling the story from any frame. It's just a story. And I'm like, well, then why isn't it first person present? It just drives me nuts.
Well, it doesn't even have to be, like, the frame doesn't even have to be in the story. And this is a thing Sherwood Smith taught me when I was trying to learn how to write omniscient, actually, is that the hot writing tip here from Sherwood Smith, master of the form, the way omniscient works is that when you are writing omniscient, what you have to keep in mind is that even omniscient has a narrator. And that narrator, even though they know everything and are in control of all the information, they have an agenda. And that agenda influences the flow of the information and the control of the information that they give the reader.
Yeah,
and I feel like that applies in first person too, even if you don't have a, you know, Pat Rothfuss-like frame story.
Right, right. First person could be super powerful that way, though. It's like when you finally realize who is, like, where the person is that's telling the story, can be really powerful. But it works very well in Karen Memory, as it were.
Yay! I feel like people will probably figure out sometime. I feel like people will probably figure out where she is when she's telling this story about halfway through the book.
Right.
You know, I because there are clues.
But we won't say any more, though. We don't want to.
No, we don't want to spoil it. Don't want to spoil the ending.
That's right. Well, you ended up getting not only a great cover, but you got Cynthia Shepherd, who.
Yes.
We don't have nearly enough women working in illustration in the field, so that was exciting.
No, and she's young and new and hot, and she's actually a classmate, former classmate of my friend Jenna Cass, who is another up and coming young artist. They came through art school together, and I believe they're both students of Donato Giancola.
Well, you could do a lot worse.
Seriously, who, you know, and Donato, well, he did the Eternal Sky covers, and I love him forever, but, I mean, he's the frickin' Michael Whalen of the modern day, even though he doesn't get the press or the street cred, but he's, you know, he's just as good. He's amazing.
Yeah, actually, he's I won't get into throwing stones. He's a better artist. I mean, maybe not as iconic in terms of the covers that he's gotten over the years, but he's a much better artist than
Michael. I don't know why he's not more iconic in the genre. That's a good word. You know, I do not know why Donato doesn't have the status of like an Alan Lee, you know, or like an Alan Lee 30 years ago, at least.
I think at least in this genre, you know, it's like Daryl Sweet is sort of this icon. It's so important about the book that you get on. And, you know, Michael Whelan had his big covers. Frank Frazetta had his big covers, you know, Daryl Sweet. It, you know, and I'm sure that,
But I mean, Donato's doing the Song of Ice and Fire calendars.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not like he's not getting big covers,
but he didn't do the Song of Ice and Fire books.
No.
You know, I don't know.
Well, because the books have those Don't Embarrass Me on the Train covers.
Now, yes.
They have bestseller covers now.
Sure, yeah. So speaking of the Eternal Sky trilogy, I'm not going to let you off the hook without mentioning it, at least. It finished up last year.
Yes.
Lots of people love it. I love it. So
I'm very glad. Speaking of books with lots of female characters doing all sorts of non-typical things.
That's right. Set in a non-Western fantasy world, which is also nice.
Not a single Red Sonja pastiche.
That's right.
That was my goal, was to get through those books with 50% female characters and no obligatory female fighter type.
Yes.
Not that I have anything against female fighter types, because I love them.
I'm very excited about the fact that the Eternal Sky trilogy is eligible for the Hugo under the Wheel of Time rule.
Under the Wheel of Time rule. Oh, yeah. The Wheel of Time rule now open for abuse.
Yes. I'm very excited about this, because I love exploiting the rules whenever possible. And it's very worthy. So watch out. If there's an organized campaign somewhere from bloggers to get that thing nominated as a trilogy, you heard about it here first.
I would be thrilled, honestly. I mean, I feel like the trilogy is some of my best work. I love the world. I'm going back to that world for another trilogy. I just started a book called The Stone in the Skull, which is the first book in the thing we're calling the Lotus Kingdoms. It's the same world as the Eternal Sky and Bone and Jewel Creatures, but it's, again, a different time period in a different place. And I had a lot of fun writing them, and it was my chance to both wallow in my love for epic fantasy and kind of take the piss out of it a little bit.
It's my favorite Britishism, by the way.
Take the piss. Yeah. Isn't that a fabulous... Because it's not something you do without love. It's not mocking. It's not... You know, you have to appreciate something to kind of want to take the piss. It's, but anyway, meanwhile.
I have kept you far too long tonight. You've got work to do. So, so let's wrap this up. Karen Memory is out this week, February the 3rd. So people should go out and get that. I've read it. It's phenomenal. Liz Burke, with whom I was G-chatting excessively just a few minutes ago, is also a big, big fan of it. So, I mean, if Liz and I agree about a book, it's got to be good.
Even if you hate it, you can frame the cover art.
There you go. There you go.
I mean, just think of it as buying a print with a book inside.
That's right.
Basically.
Bear, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right.
This has been fun. Thank you for listening to this incredibly long interview.
Anytime. I'm sure everybody. Come on. I'm answering for my listeners. Anytime. This has been Rocket Talk.